Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
It's really important from a public health standpoint that we don't let our guard down.
It was lonely. It was painful to have basically no contact other than yelling up and down the stairs to people.
It's been practically 4 weeks of declining hospitalizations. We're about 53% below peak.
I'm really not sure my job's even going to be there when all of this ends.
I'm taking it, hydroxychloroquine, because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories.
This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. Those are some of the voices from this week's news, including President Trump and Connecticut residents Doug Schwan and Sarah Kitt, who spoke to Connecticut Public Radio. You also heard the acting public health commissioner, Dr. Deidre Gifford, and Governor Ned Lamont. Today is reopening day, or phase one, as Connecticut's economy slowly starts back up after a two-month shutdown to contain the spread of COVID-19. The governor says people who are able to work from home should continue to do so, especially if they're over 65 or have certain medical conditions. But the reopening doesn't mean business as usual. In fact, there are significant restrictions on businesses. Restaurants will be allowed to serve customers again, but only outside dining. Shopping malls and offices can open up, but staff and customers must wear masks. Outdoor recreation like mini golf will resume. Hair salons were on the list, but now customers will have to wait a little bit longer. We'll get into that in just a moment. First on the panel today, it's probably not a stretch to say some of us really need a haircut. Dan Haar joins us, columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media. He's on Zoom today. Hi, Dan.
Hi, audio only. Need a haircut.
Susan Raff is also with us, chief capital reporter for Eyewitness News, Channel 3. Susan, welcome to The Wheelhouse.
Good morning.
And then also with us is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Lucy.
You can join us, too. Find us on Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. I'll start with you, Dan. Should the state of Connecticut be slowly reopening today?
We are. We should. And absolutely. The question is how. And that's the complexity. There's no question that the time has come to do some of these openings up. And the only question is how and what. And so far, the governor is taking a middle path, which I think is right. And the devil is in the details.
Mm. Colin, do you agree?
I mean, I agree with the sentiment of what Dan's saying. I think it's worth noting that the essential bargain that we initially struck was that there would be a closing down in Connecticut and across the country while the public health response ramped up so that we could then reopen, continuing with social distancing practices, but we would have in place this robust public health response that would include a huge amount of testing and the ability to do contact tracing. And that hasn't really happened. It certainly hasn't happened nationally. I would argue it hasn't happened adequately here in Connecticut. So this is a little bit more of a roll of the dice than I think had initially been anticipated.
Colin, we know that the governor has said for a long time that the state should be reaching a testing target for about 42,000 tests per week. You had said in your column that's a puny benchmark. Why?
Well, I mean, first of all, one of the things that I would like the governor to start saying is exactly that. Here's why. Here's why 42,000 a week is enough. There's sort of two golden standards right now. One of them is the Harvard Global Health Initiative, which actually developed a tool for measuring the severity of an outbreak and the population of a state. And they think Connecticut should have 29,000 and change tests per day. And you can look up any state on this tool they have. The other one is the World Health Organization, which says that if you are getting more than 10% positives, then you're not testing enough. Basically, it means that you're testing symptomatic people and frontline workers. You're not testing big enough so that you would catch the super spreader who's waiting in the Dairy Queen line, who doesn't have any other identifying characteristics. So, and we're not there either. I haven't looked at that ratio in a while, but, you know, for quite a while, we were running around 25% positive among our tests. So, you know, those those aren't good numbers. Those would be numbers that would suggest to me that we're not doing enough tests. And what would help would be if Governor Lamont or Albert Koh or somebody would say, here's why we think 42,000 a week is enough. That would help me a little bit anyway, understand the thinking.
Susan, because we're in the media, we're thinking about these questions and we're in up to our necks in all of these details and these numbers. But when you're out there talking with residents around the state, you know, how do they view the reopening today and the question about, you know, have we done enough testing?
Right. Well, I think you're right. I mean, we've spent a lot of time over the past few weeks with businesses and restaurants. Yesterday, we were at the Connecticut Post Mall. And I think a lot of businesses obviously want to reopen, but they're also anxious because they want to get it right. And they want people to feel comfortable about going out. I mean, you can do all the steps and have all the masks and social distancing, but if people don't feel comfortable about going back out, you know, the business is not going to pick up and we're going to be in a tough spot.
Dan, has the governor and the members of his reopen advisory committee, have they done a good enough job convincing the public that it's safe to start going out as long as they practice social distancing and wearing masks, as Susan said?
I think they have done a good enough job convincing the public that it is appropriately safe. That is, that they don't want to run around saying, yes, it's safe, run out and you know, go look like that group in Colorado in the woods and all that stuff. They want to have a measured position, and they are doing that. The issue is whether they're doing enough to prepare businesses and people for precisely what they should be doing. And that's a different issue, and I think the answer there is not quite.
Mm-hmm. Colin, as far as enforcement, so again, we're hearing from the governor that people should wear masks when they're in public. Restaurants and others that are reopening in this phase one, they need to follow certain guidelines. But who is really going to be enforcing this?
I think, well, for the most part, there isn't any way for there to be an enforcement mechanism the way we, say, enforce speed limits, although everybody this week had a look at a very stressed out state cop who's just completely going nuts on some motorists. So, I mean, even that enforcement is kind of straining at its edges. I don't think there is a way to enforce it other than to hope that people will cooperate with one another. What we've seen in other places sometimes is if store owners say to shoppers, you have to wear a mask, here's one of our complimentary masks, whatever. You know, there's a certain percentage of shoppers who don't want to do it. And at that point, you do have kind of a situation on your hands. And you also don't want your own security guard, your mall security guard, or your Costco, you know, security person to have to escort somebody out. First of all, that involves a breakdown of social distancing in itself. It's a little bit tricky. And I don't think that there is a playbook for what happens when somebody says no.
Dan, we know that other states in the country have reopened, including Georgia. I mean, what's it looking like there?
Well, we're not seeing quite the throngs of people. I think what you're seeing elsewhere, and I mentioned Colorado as well, mm-hmm. and we all know about Wisconsin. We all saw pictures of the bar scenes there this past week, or was it last week? The weeks all blend together now after the Supreme Court ruling there. And what I think we're seeing is not mass movements anywhere like a fad, like all of a sudden everybody's out, but we see spots, you know, you see like a almost like a little mini hotspot, you know, people will get together. But the story out of Georgia is that the people of Georgia are behind, are trailing the government, you know, the less enlightened governor of Georgia, who thinks that the state should just open all the way up. And I think that's what Lamont keeps saying is going to happen here. I think he thinks there'll be less crowds today at lunch outside in West Hartford, New Haven, and elsewhere than I think. I think it's going to be a crowded day out there.
Mm. And Susan, where are you headed today to kind of get the idea of if people are comfortable coming out today? And as the weather continues to be nice, are we going to start to see more crowds developing?
Well, we are headed to West Hartford Center. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. But I think what we're seeing also, which is really interesting, is that businesses themselves are being creative. We were at Eli Cannon's yesterday in Middletown. They're taking reservations because they don't want to get the throngs of people and showing up. So you have to have a reservation. The mall, for example, in Milford, they are doing something called order to go. So you can order online, you can drive to the mall and park, and they will bring it to you. So it's interesting how they're trying to get around that. But a lot of businesses are not reopening. Only about 20% of the retailers at the Connecticut Post Mall are going to open. You know, if you don't have outdoor seating, you're not going to open today. I think cities and towns are being a little more flexible now with allowing restaurants to put tables and chairs outside. But I don't think you're going to see, you know, the numbers of people. It's not a mass reopening. But again, it's an important first step, and they're hoping coming in the next 2 weeks or so that more will come online.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of businesses that were set to reopen, a lot of people expecting hair salons to be open. Dan Haar, you wrote about maybe this being another one of the missteps of the governor's administration, where the plan was today, but there was a lot of feedback from operators. They were concerned they didn't have enough time. What does that mean in terms of when we look at the overall strategy and process that the governor and his team have put together? How does that rollback impact the effectiveness of the administration?
The misstep is in the timing, the misstep and the mm-hmm. communication. The misstep is not in the decision to roll back hair salons. I think, you know, the science says that continues to be a somewhat risky process. And just going back a step, every bit of this has risk. We aren't going to open anything if the risk goes down to zero. And I think in an overall sort of umbrella way of looking at this, there are two types of people in the world, and I've written about this, as Colin has as well, the ones who love chaos and the ones who require extreme order. This is not a good crisis for people who like a whole lot of order in everything, because there just simply aren't going to be answers. And with the hair salons, there was no clear answer. The governor wavered, and as Don Meredith used to say on I'm dating myself, on Monday Night Football, he who hesitates is lost, and made a reversal of an already established decision. That was the problem. And that highlighted the other problems that were in the reopening, as, for example, not telling the public that Boston Consulting Group had been hired a month or so earlier. None of these are killer problems. It's all just part of a very complicated process. I don't want to portray it as a botched reopening. It is not at all. He's doing generally a good job, but these are missteps.
Colin, what do you think? I'm looking at a headline from the day today that there's a Pawcatuck barbershop owner who said she still plans to reopen this morning in defiance of Governor Ned Lamont, again, to delay the opening of barbershops and salons until next month.
I would first of all like to point out that He Who Hesitates Is Lost appears in Joseph Addison's play Cato, which is the same play from which Nathan Hale got his famous, my only regret is that I have one life to live, lose for my country. So anyway, I don't think we're going to be allowed. I would not anticipate the arrest or fining of defiant barbershop owners. I think, first of all, this whole thing is in its maiden state. You know, we don't really know enough to know how to handle acts of defiance. And I also feel as though the acts of defiance themselves, you know, I mean, they're like little micro outbursts. And I'm not really sure that the optics would be all that great if you did arrest this. I mean, on the one hand, you want to do something or say something that indicates the seriousness of the order and the restrictions imposed upon the reopening, all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, the optics of, you know, frog marching away some little barbershop owner or something like that, that doesn't seem like it's a plus either. My guess is that they'll just sort of, as much as possible, turn a blind eye to this stuff. And as Danny is suggesting, you know, a lot of this is going to be determined by consumers. We all need haircuts. How much risk are we willing to endure in order to get a haircut? You know, I mean, maybe the people who are that risk taking and want a haircut that bad, I mean, they're going to be there. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be sitting in that barber chair, and I think a lot of people wouldn't either.
Susan, speaking of hair salons, and again, the governor working with many operators thinking about delaying the opening for another couple of weeks, you've been covering or talking with dentists and dental hygienists, and again, how the governor is working with them on a plan to handle dental work, whether they're non-emergencies or emergencies. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the dental industry, just like the hair stylists and hair salons and barbershops, you know, there's a lot of division. There are some who want to open today, and there are some who don't. I think with dental hygienists, they've been very strong. They have a very strong lobbying group. They've been very vocal. And they have some real legitimate concerns. I mean, people, their patients, their mouths are open, and they would prefer to wait. The governor did do a little bit of a change with that. It, as you know, dentists have been open during this time, but only for emergency procedures. And the push was to have more routine procedures be allowed starting today, teeth cleanings, et cetera. And dental hygienists were very much against it. Now it's optional. So if a dental practice wants to reopen and or have teeth cleaning starting today, they can. But that definitely puts a lot of dental hygienists in a situation. In fact, I believe at 10 o'clock this morning, they are planning somewhat of a protest. Because if they don't go to work and they're supposed to be doing these procedures, they could lose their unemployment. So that's a concern for them.
You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You're hearing panelist Susan Raff, Chief Capitol Reporter for Channel 3 Eyewitness News. Dan Haar is also here, columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media. And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show, also a columnist at Hearst Connecticut. Coming up, the fish rots from the head down. The words of a State Department of Public Health employee. We'll explain after the break. You can join us too. Find us on Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. On our panel today, Dan Haar, columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media, Susan Raff, who's chief Capitol reporter at Channel 3 Eyewitness News, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Now, the state health department should take the lead in how Connecticut responds to a disease outbreak, but the agency has had some other issues to deal with. As we talked about last week, Commissioner Renee Coleman Mitchell was fired recently by the governor in the middle of the pandemic, and an internal survey found morale problems before coronavirus became widespread in the state. The Hartford Courant's Dave Altomare dug into this issue. I want to start with you, Dan. What do we know about the morale of the DPH?
What we know about the morale of the DPH is that, like a lot of us who are working every day, you know, all the time, and I think that would include everyone certainly on this call, in this show, there's a lot of stress. So, you know, cut off my legs and call me Shorty. A deputy commissioner quits angrily. A commissioner is not doing her job and gets fired. And there's morale problems. This is not, people are dying. I think there's enough already with this morale problems. I don't ascribe to that any big public health problem. People are stressed in and out of the Connecticut Department of Public Health. There was a commissioner who did not get the job done and was fired. And that's the end of it. I'm not clear on what all the Sturm und Drang is about the morale.
There was an interesting quotable line from that internal survey, the fish rots from the head down. Colin, what's your take after hearing Dan's point?
Well, as usual, I don't agree. it's clear from, first of all, I think that you kind of misphrased what was revealed in Altomare's story, which is that these morale problems preceded the pandemic. People were upset. People were leaving. Among other things that he found, I think it was six people from the epidemiology department had left. We're having an epidemic right now. Those people had already left. So you have a situation where, you know, going forward, public health workers are going to be in demand. There's going to be kind of a seller's market if you're a public health worker. We don't have a commissioner. We don't have a deputy commissioner. And yes, this was a very demoralized department where people didn't feel valued. And a lot of people left and had left before the pandemic broke out. So, yeah, it's a problem. And it sort of leads to the fact that absent a functioning DPH, which we have a non-functioning DPH, Boston Consulting Group is going to come in, and I think they're going to be kind of the de facto Department of Public Health. And they may be the de facto government of Connecticut, ultimately, because all of these decisions involve multiple departments, you know, whether it's a blow dryer or something else. It's public health, it's labor, it's economic development, it's social services. All these things kind of meld together. And it's not good to have this particular department be the sick man of Europe. And it's also just unfortunate that things were allowed to go to this really, really scary extreme before we all got started with COVID-19.
Dan?
I don't disagree with that. I think that management science matters, and I don't mean to say that the management and the organizational structure and the morale of a group of people doesn't matter. What I do mean to say is that in the face of this crisis, people are doing their jobs, and if people are unhappy about this, that, or the other thing, the media has the ability, and not just the media, you know, the overall observers have the ability to overstate that. And that's all I was saying. I'm not belittling the problems. And I do agree that some departments, and that was one of them, have been allowed to slide long before this. And we saw with the vaccination crisis where there was a problem in that department. So I don't want to understate or overstate my position that the morale problems are way, way, way smaller than the crisis as a whole.
Hmm. Susan, you've been covering the Capitol for some time. When we think about stress within state departments, there have been a lot of reductions under the Malloy administration. Some of that has continued under the Lamont administration. Is that where some of this frustration and morale issues may come from, because there just aren't enough people to do the work?
I'm not sure. And not hearing that from people, that it's a question of that. I think you have to have strong leadership. I think that the commissioner, if you remember back in August, there were problems. Connecticut was embroiled in the vaccination debate, and Renee Coleman Mitchell made the decision not to release information that showed vaccination rates at individual schools. And then I think it was 2 days later that Governor Lamont ordered that be released. So I think there's been tension between them. I understand that the commissioner also was not good at communicating with other agencies. And I think that's very critical at this time, whether it's social services, all the agencies really have to work together. But I agree, there's a lot of pressure. And if an agency or within the Department of Public Health are struggling to coordinate, now you add a pandemic to that, I think it definitely makes it tense. I'm not sure how the acting commissioner now can pull it together in this time, but they clearly are out in front. You know, usually they're not getting this much publicity, so I think the light is very bright.
Colin, I wanted to go back to you when you mentioned Boston Consulting Group and whether this consulting agency would be the de facto public health department for the state of Connecticut. Let's talk more about this relationship. What do we know about, again, how BCG will be working with the state on phase two and beyond?
We know certain things, but not others. I just want to sort of put a button on what we just said here, too. I mean, an indication that Ned Lamont didn't have much faith in his Department of Public Health is when he impaneled that so-called reopening task force. You know, there was like 50 members if you did all the subcommittees. But there was a steering committee, a core group of about 8 people. Not only was Renee Coleman Mitchell, the Department of Public Health commissioner, not in that group, but the state epidemiologist, Matthew Carter, was not also in that core group. So, you know, all the things that we talked about in the first segment, how you decide whether hair salons can open, how you decide whether, you know, what's going to happen with dental practices. The core group making those decisions did not include anybody from the Department of Public Health. And my guess is that with the Boston Consulting Group, we can sort of see that their contract has all kinds of, you know, sort of consultant gibberish that makes it hard really to understand exactly what they're talking about. It's one of those things that uses work planning as one word.
Control towers.
Control towers. But I mean, if you cut through the gibberish, it seems to me that basically Governor Lamont doesn't feel as though he has a state government that can do interagency planning, that there are some significant weak spots. He's not all that comfortable with government anyway, I don't think, and he's probably a little bit more comfortable with Boston Consulting Group. I anticipate that they will be essentially, alongside Josh Jabal and a few other key Lamont administration people and some commissioners, they will begin to constitute the executive planning arm of the state government. And once again, the question is going to come up, will we have the same kind of access and oversight to the decisions that they make that are essentially public policy decisions as we would ordinarily do with state government? Or are we once again in this kind of murky area? We're going to be talking about it again in a few seconds, where you've got private sector people coming in doing government jobs and not wanting to comply with oversight.
Dan, pick up on that. Again, no elected officials in this core group of Reopen Connecticut Advisory Committee. Freezing out lawmakers, is that problematic?
Yeah, I think, yes, I agree with Colin on that one. I don't think they were without public health expertise. The two who spoke yesterday at the briefing, Ezekiel Emanuel and Scott Gottlieb, one Democrat, one Republican, experts on public health to a great extent, both have written extensively about the reopening, and they are core advisors, more so than we may believe. And so it may be a matter of looking at metrics and saying, these are the metrics we need to have. I fully agree that that statement about the leadership is strong, that Lamont doesn't have faith in Colin. And I would add that I think it's a mistake to put the commissioner of already the largest single department as measured by spending in charge of this other critically important department at the same time, as capable as she is. There needs to be a person in charge of DPH.
Can I just quickly add one thing to what Danny's saying? I have a tremendous amount of respect for Scott Gottlieb and Zeke Emanuel. Those are incredibly busy people. Scott Gottlieb is one of the busiest guys in America right now on the public health front. He doesn't work for the state of Connecticut, whereas Matthew Carter works full-time for the state of Connecticut. So once again, to have on your core panel some people who have really literally dozens and dozens of other people tugging at their coattails saying, tell us what to do, Scott Gottlieb, and to suggest that that's a replacement for the full-time epidemiologist of the state of Connecticut indicates a little bit about what Ned Lamont thinks about government.
Susan, we didn't have time to pay his taxes, so that you're absolutely
right. Let's not get into that one.
Susan Raff, we heard Dan mention Dr. Deidre Gifford. Again, she's the commissioner of DSS, now the acting commissioner of DPH. I believe she's a physician. I think she's got a background in epidemiology. She's now coming out on these daily briefings. I mean, what is the feeling out there? What are you hearing from lawmakers and others about her leading DPH now?
Well, you're right. She definitely has some credentials. I think she, you know, has a doctorate. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that she does. She has studied epidemiology. You know, it's interesting, the legislature. I mean, it's been silent a lot. And you don't hear from a lot of lawmakers. Certainly, I know Len Pisano has weighed in on a couple things. I think you have a lot of dynamics within the General Assembly. You have key people like Pisano and Claritas who are not running again, Eric Simowitz, all of those people. And I'm curious why they haven't been more vocal about certain things. It's almost like they're taking a back seat and letting the governor kind of do his executive orders. I think what Colin had said earlier, you know, there's no roadmap, so no one really knows what to do. But I am a little bit surprised by that. I haven't heard a lot of comments from the legislature. Agree?
What do you think, Colin?
Well, yeah. I mean, they've tried to comment. But at the moment, and I think we said this last week, you know, I mean, Ned Lamont has sort of imposed a temporary monarchy here. You know, Plato and Socrates in the Republic talk about how you can't really have a boat that's run by a democracy. There has to be a captain. And you can have everybody's opinion cannot count equally. And I think Lamont, not unreasonably, decided that this is the state of Connecticut's a boat right now. It's got a captain, and the captain makes decisions, and everybody doesn't get to weigh in on those decisions. You know, which I think, as a temporary thing, as a state of emergency, is understandable, viable, and justifiable. But ultimately, we are a democracy. Ultimately, those other voices are going to have to count and be meaningful. And when we get to the next topic in this segment, we're going to see what happens when you shut those people up. They start looking for a chance to talk about something. and they'll start talking in ways that will displease you. So, yeah, I think there's a sort of a lot of pent-up oppositional commentary that it's going to come out some way or another.
So Colin's chomping at the bit to talk about Dalio Philanthropies. This is
a
big
story. I already disagree, and he hasn't said anything yet.
This is a big story that popped up just yesterday. Dalio Philanthropies pulling out of the Partnership for Connecticut. This public-private partnership led by hedge fund giant Ray and Barbara Dalio was an effort to help disadvantaged children. It was supposed to be funded with $100 million from the Dalios, another $100 from the state, and another $100 million from donors to be named later. Then the statement came out where Barbara Dalio laid blame for their withdrawal at the feet of the two top Republicans in the state house, Representatives Themis Claridis and Vince Candelora. Recently, the partnership also placed its newly hired CEO on paid administrative leave. And before all of that controversy, much criticism was directed at the fact that the governor and the General Assembly last year allowed this partnership to be exempt from state open government laws and from ethics laws. Dan, should the public be surprised the venture ended this way?
Yes, I was surprised, and I do think that it's surprising. I think that it indicates that the Dalios, led by Barbara Dalio in Connecticut on the education side, gave up a little bit too soon in the fight. I thought that they were in for a battle over this. I think they would ultimately have won the battle over public disclosure. I think they were doing a good job of running a board that was operating more or less like school boards in Connecticut in terms of how they function, albeit without the FOI requirements. And I was surprised that they pulled out, and not necessarily because of that FOI issue, although that was part of it. It was because of the constant leaks and constant jabbing by those people you mentioned and some others from the board side and in and out of the board, I should say. And they essentially walked away. I should make it very clear that they didn't walk away with their money. Their money remains through Dalio Philanthropies in those same causes. And if anything, they've upped the amount because they agreed to pay for the 60,000 laptops.
So why did they even start this partnership with the state of Connecticut, Colin, if they're going to pledge another $100 million or so and continue to do this work to help inner city kids? Why go through all of this?
This is the question I have been asking and asking without really much of an answer. But yes, they created their own problems. They could have simply functioned as a philanthropic organization and helped out in the schools in any number of ways. But public-private partnerships are very much in vogue, and they wanted to be one of these things. And I don't think they understood what went along with this. And what we haven't mentioned so far is the thing that I think is the trigger, which is a John Lender piece in the Hartford Courant on Sunday, in which it turns out that the executive director who had been hired to run this partnership for $250,000 a year in salary, after 2 months on the job, was so displeasing to the core group running this partnership that they fired her. And they fired her, according to her, in such an unpleasant, brutish, and ham-fisted way that she, like a lot of people who were getting fired from really good jobs, decided to take her case to the other board members. Look what they're doing to me. They're threatening me. They're doing this. They're doing that. Now, the problem now is the other board members do include elected officials. So this stuff then leaks out. I mean, it's not like the private sector where you can fire somebody and then, you know, drag their body out to the parking lot and Harvey Keitel comes and picks it up and nobody ever knows what, who got fired for what, or, you know, this is the public sector. They wanted to be in the public sector and they look stupid. It looks like they hired the wrong person. They went through all the resumes and hired somebody who in 2 months revealed herself, according to them, to be completely wrong for this job.
That's not what they said.
Well, or that there's something in her background or something. Well, I mean, once again, they look stupid for not vetting her then, if that's what the problem is. And then they fired her in the wrong way, too. But nobody would know any of this if, in fact, they hadn't insisted on $100 million of taxpayer money being part of this whole equation and therefore elected officials there to know about something like this. Now, I will please Danny a little bit by saying, yeah, Vince Candelora kind of jumped the gun here a little bit. I mean, he turned this into a political issue and made it much more public than it typically would have been, even if it were happening within state government. But this was kind of a club that was handed to him. And it's not unusual for the opposition party to use clubs that are handed to them to beat on the ruling party.
And I would add, it's not just Republicans. It's not just Vince Candelora and Temis Claris. There were Democrats on the same side.
Yeah.
I think
Go ahead, Susan.
I think you can have your cake and eat it, too. I think that I remember when they announced this partnership, and I think all of us were kind of, rolling our eyes, not quite sure how this was going to work. You know, great, they're going to give Connecticut money, and they're going to help education and help children. But, you know, I think they wanted to do it under the guise of, you know, this is how we want to do it, and we don't want people poking and prodding. And I think, you know, legislators are just not comfortable with that. And I agree, had they done it in a different way, it could have been handled differently. But, you know, when you handle things this way, people poke around and they want to know where things are going. So I think it was just handled poorly from the start. I think that the intent maybe was good, but obviously the end result is not.
Dan, in Barbara Dalio's statement, she said that they, being representatives, Claridis and Candelora, sought to sabotage the partnership. That's a pretty strong accusation. Is it accurate?
Very strong. I think I would have fallen short of that language. I think what they were doing is what they do every day as the loyal opposition, and say, you know, this is not the way this should happen. They were very upset from the outset about the FOI and the ethics exemption. And that's a viable and legitimate debate. Colin is on that side of it. I disagree. I think what they were doing was fully in the spirit of openness. But, you know, let's take a step back here. And let's say that what Connecticut has done for young people ages 14 to 20 who are disenfranchised from the system in the poorest performing school systems is not adequate. We can agree to that. And what Zuckerberg tried to do in Newark, and what Gates tried to do in New York City, and in so many other places where philanthropists come in, the reason they want to do it with the public is that they're trying to leverage their money, which is not enough, to change a system in the value of the billions of dollars. That's what the Dalios were doing. What they did right was they are here. They're not parachuting in like Zuckerberg in Newark. They are here. Barbara Dalio is physically driving from Greenwich to Norwalk, to Bridgeport, to New Haven, to Hartford, and working with these people.
I wanted to say, I think we all know who wrote that statement. It certainly wasn't Barbara Dalio. And that statement has the kind of characteristic language of the person who wrote it. But, I mean, what I objected to in the statement was the phrase, the broken system of government. I think that was the phrase. The word broken was in there. Well, no, we have a partisan system of government here. And one of the ways that we had tried previously, honorably, to address our broken system of government was to put in sunlight laws and watchdog reforms, which this particular entity was trying to defy, or had tried to defy. It did not have an immaculate conception. And so to say that our government is broken is offensive to me, given the fact that they were trying to do an end around on one of the things that I think makes our government less broken.
Ask any of the 39,000 target youth people who are not well served whether our government is broken.
Well, I'm not suggesting our government isn't broken in other ways, but not in the way that this statement is suggesting.
Susan, before we head to break, is there a common theme here in Governor Lamont's administration, this lack of respect for public access to information, whether it's the Dalio Partnership, the Boston Consulting Group contract, even the governor's advisory panel?
You know, I'm not sure, but I know that from the start, Governor Lamont was very insistent about public-private partnerships. He started right out of the gate with that. And I think the public wants that, because what we're seeing now with this outside consulting firm, that he seems to have confidence or more confidence in the private sector doing a better job in navigating through things than the government. But, you know, it is a different arrangement, and it does open, you know, the door for, you know, questions and transparency, and people want that. So I think there are pluses and minuses. Does the governor favor that? I think he does. He comes from the private sector, and he relies on a lot of private sector expertise. I mean, David Layman from DECD, a lot of people who he's put in place. But it does open the door, I think, to, you know, people want information and transparency.
That's Susan Raff, who's the chief capital reporter at Channel 3 Eyewitness News. Also here with us, Dan Haar, columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media, and Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio. Coming up, we take a look at the economic fallout from the pandemic. It's not pretty. And then we'll hear our feats of strength and airing of grievances. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You can find us on Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. On the panel today, Susan Raff, chief capital reporter for Channel 3 Eyewitness News, Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show, also a columnist at Hearst Connecticut, and Dan Haar, columnist and associate editor at Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, we've been talking a lot about Governor Lamont. You'll be speaking with him soon. What's happening there?
Yes, we have a webinar tomorrow. And that is, anyone can register. It's 11:30 a.m. to 12. And then we have a panel discussing the reopening. We're going to be talking about the reopening the whole hour. And that is bit.ly/CTReopens, if anyone wants to register. Thank you for that.
And we'll make sure that we put it out on our Twitter feed, Dan. Right now, we want to focus on the unemployment rate in our country. Nationwide, it stands at nearly 15% because of the COVID-19 shutdown. That's the highest level seen since the Great Depression. And the next monthly jobs report from the state labor department is scheduled to be released tomorrow. Connecticut Labor Commissioner Kurt Westby has said recently, unemployment here could be roughly 20%. Dan, how bad does it look for Connecticut in terms of trying to regain some of these jobs lost?
Well, it's bad at the moment, of course, but I don't think the comparison to the Depression, when we had 25% unemployment in, I believe, 1933, is apt, because that was a demand-based decline in jobs, and this is a supply base. We're cutting off the supply of workers, and so naturally that's happening. We are in for a relatively short but still long recovery in the 1 to 1.5 years range. So it's not going to right away bounce back, as we're going to see today, that everybody is not back working at restaurants. So I think, again, a middle path here. You can overstate or understate how bad it is. It is bad, but we've never before seen a $3 trillion or anything close to it response by the federal government. Even in 2008 and 2009, we didn't see anything close to this in terms of direct aid to the people affected. So that's going to bounce the recovery a little faster than it would have been.
When we look at how we stack up in the region, Dan, you know, how are our neighboring states, when we think about the jobs that were regained after the recession, in terms of what our economic picture looks like, is Mass still looking better than us?
Massachusetts is always going to look better than us because of the mix of industries there, and especially education, which seems to be impervious to everything. But Connecticut, so Massachusetts is one of the top performing states in terms of how bad off they're going to be with tax revenue. However, Connecticut is in the top tier. And so for once, according to a Moody's report that I reported on, Connecticut is in the top 10 states of ones that will be least affected, at least in the first year, by tax declines because of our mix of industry and because of other factors. And on top of that, it's mainly the mix of industries that is defense and to an extent finance are bulwarks and insurance. But we also have the $2.5 going to $2.8 billion reserve fund. And so when you combine those, we are actually, according to Moody's, only the 7th worst hit state in the first year and a half on this thing. That's pretty good for Connecticut, which is used to being the in the bottom.
But how quickly will that reserve fund go, Dan, in the next year?
The projections are that the reserve fund will cover the first full year, but that's just about it. And so then we start to have trouble following that. So there is no question that there's going to be a need, if this should last into fiscal 22. That is starting July 1st of 21, a year and a couple of months from now, that we're going to have to start cutting back. And that's where the debate about labor unions and taxes on the rich, as we saw this week, starts to kick in again.
Susan Raff, when we talk about unemployment, it's easy to focus on the numbers, but let's drill down and think more about some of the people that are affected in our state. You know, who have you spoken with, and what are the sectors that are really hurting right now?
Well, I think you have, you know, obviously hairstylists, a lot of restaurants, you know, they are, devastated by what's happening. I think it's 10% of our workforce in Connecticut. And I agree. I think that, you know, this we will, you know, those jobs will slowly come back, not as slow as obviously the Great Depression. But I think you're going to see a lot of businesses, small businesses, that are not going to come back because I think they've lost so much money. I think what's really important, too, is that the government is really critical in all of this, not just the money that's coming out of Washington and the federal stimulus. You know, with unemployment now, people get an additional $600 a week. But the Department of Economic Development is giving bridge loans to small businesses to help them ride the storm. I think some 5,000 people or different companies have applied, and they've paid out about $15,000 so far, and there's more to come. So I think it's critical that government play such a strong role in helping these companies, and if they can keep them afloat, then we'll be better off, because if they close, you know, who knows what will come in its place.
We're going to have to move on now to feats of strength. Colin McEnroe.
I'm going to do not a feat of strength, but a grievance. There was a phrase in the great series The Wire, juking the stats, which was applied not only to cops inflating their crime reduction stats, but also to the educational system skewing test scores to make itself look better. We're starting to see that with COVID-19 in Virginia, Texas, and Vermont. They've been combining the results of the diagnostic tests with the antibody tests to get this kind of weird, more impressive looking number. In Florida, they fired the person who created their statistical dashboard, who said she was fired for refusing to manipulate stats to drum up support for the plan to reopen. In Georgia, they have used at least one graph, which makes it look as though cases are declining in a county, when in fact the cases are just being listed in a declining order. So we need reliable stats from the government. We can't have them playing games with this. It's really dangerous if they do.
Susan Raff.
Well, I think on a personal level, I remember when this started and hearing, you know, we're in this together all the time and looking and reading and seeing on TV. And you know, at times we go to the grocery store and we're all in masks, and it seems like a bad horror movie, like we're walking zombies with masks. And I think that we have our moments, you know, and it's been difficult. A lot of people are losing their jobs. I have a daughter who's in high school. She's a senior. You know, her senior year has been crushed, and who knows what happens with college. But I have to look around and say, you know, we are alive and we're healthy. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. And I hope that we get through this sooner than later.
Thanks, Susan. And Dan, we got about one and a half minutes. Go ahead.
I'm going to give a feat of strength to our competitors, the staff at the Hartford Current, who are operating under the horrific ownership of a Alden Capital, which has instituted pay cuts and furloughs, mandatory furloughs. Those guys are doing great work. I get that, you know, it's the Yankees and the Red Sox with us and them, but on a personal level, I see tremendous heart and some pretty good stories too by them, some of which we've mentioned on this show. Mm-hmm. I want to especially say to the Altamares, who have two people in that situation and doing some great work. And so our friends at the Hartford Current deserve a shout out.
Thank you, Dan. That's right. Subscribe to local Connecticut media if you can. I'll just quickly do a grievance. The New Haven Register reported three Town of East Haven clerical workers have been placed on administrative leave pending further investigation after the town learned they may have collected unemployment while the town was paying them their full wages, even though they weren't working because of the coronavirus pandemic. Shame on them. Today's show produced by Matt Dwyer. I want to thank our great panel today, Susan Raff from Channel 3, Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, and of course, Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Our tech producer is Kat Pastor. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We'll be back next week.